Well, unfortunately, the audio for study number two did not record very well, so I'm going to give this just an overview to the microphone here for the benefit of those that are going through these notes. And the question that we're looking at here today really is, the issue we're looking at is the men that we're focusing upon. You'll notice that there were 151 men who were summoned to form this assembly. There were 30 laymen, 121 divines. In our Sunday school room, I got asked the question about, you know, why were these men called divines and so on, and this was a Puritan term. They certainly did not deify clergymen, but it was synonymous with a clergyman. A layman, of course, is those who are called to other employments, but who do give of their time and talents to the work of the church. And those who are gifted in various areas may assist in legal matters, for example. Now, the religious makeup of these men, they were based from Episcopalians, Presbyterians, and Independents. There were also a small number of Erastians. Now, this shows that the makeup of the Westminster Assembly was not a given as to what they would produce. These things had to be debated, discussed, and voted upon. And in the Assembly, all these doctrines and positions had to be aired. So it was a very lively Assembly, very lively debate, especially in the area of church government, in which there would be the widest difference of opinion. And the Erastians, you'll notice a box there referring to Thomas Erastus, who taught that matters of church discipline should be exercised by the civil magistrate, and that the state had the authority, the supreme authority, over the church, and had the ability to punish people for unspiritual matters. Now, that was refuted by the majority in the Westminster Assembly, and Presbyterians certainly did not hold to that, and the moderate Episcopalians did not hold to that, and of course the Independents, they were totally, absolutely against that, and therefore the Erastians were in the minority, and their views, while they very strongly set them out, they were not accepted. The next question is, how were the men of the Assembly chosen? And Mr. Beveridge, whom we quote here from his little book, says that two were appointed by each representative in the Parliament. And so they were brought from all areas of the country. They were not brought from one institution, one denomination, but they were brought from all parts of the country and asked to sit. There were seven men brought from Scotland, four ministers and three laymen. Those four ministers were Alexander Henderson, Samuel Rutherford, Robert Bailey, and George Gillespie. I'm on page two, second paragraph. Four ministers, Alexander Henderson, Samuel Rutherford, Robert Bailey, and George Gillespie. Those are four outstanding names, four outstanding characters in church history, in Scottish church history, and Alexander Henderson in particular, of whom we're going to learn much today. Now, the chairman of the Assembly is a very important matter, and he was Dr. William Twiss. He had the task of being the chairperson to moderate, to direct, and to schedule the events, and to direct the debates and discussions. He was a very moderate man, so therefore he was suited to the task, but he was also a very learned man, a man of maturity. He was probably in his 70s at this time, and a man who died in the office, did not see the work completed, but was there for the majority of the time. He was a man who was in no rush. He was willing to give every man his time and place, and while some wanted to move on in a faster pace, Dr. Twiss would have put the brakes on, and he was certainly a very suited man for the task. capable, yet level-headed, and not willing to rush anything. And of course, the Westminster Assembly was a huge task that took over a number of years, in 1643, right through to 47, and indeed on to 49 for the catechisms. So it was a large, large task, and it needed a leader, a man in the chair who would direct all of these affairs and be a moderating influence against hotheads and any that would become impatient. Now, these men were very well qualified, and of course we know that from the very document that they produced, but it is unquestionable that they were men of learning, men of ability, men that were well suited for their task, and thereby they were able to silence their opponents and false doctrines and handle the most delicate issues of doctrine. You'll notice Richard Baxter, and going back up to the top of page 2 here, Richard Baxter, that he, although he did not sit in, he testified that be not worthy to be one of them myself, I may the more freely speak that truth which I know, even in the face of malice and envy, that the Christian world had never a synod of more excellent divines, taking one thing with another, than this synod and the Synod of Dort. And so, the testimony of an impartial voice at the time sets out the learning and the ability of these men. Now, the outstanding Scottish representative of the Westminster Assembly was Alexander Henderson. He was a spiritual and a political giant who proposed, the man who actually initially proposed the crafting of a confession, and had the vision to work for a reformed statement to unite the three kingdoms, Scotland, England, and Ireland. This man was a visionary, and he understood how it might be done, and went about it not in a small, narrow-minded fashion, but with a desire to incorporate the three kingdoms of the British Isles. And one has said that Henderson is one of the greatest men in the history of Scotland, and next to Knox is certainly the most famous of Scottish ecclesiastics. And all that we know about this man certainly impresses us. The years that he spent in Lucre's in a pastoral ministry, his learning, his ability to stand for the truth. And then, and if you move to page 3, to the write-up that is beside the picture that is in the notes here, you'll notice that he came to the fore in the years when Charles I was at his worst, when he was seeking to foist Episcopalianism upon the Scottish Presbyterians. And out of necessity, Alexander Henderson came to the fore to withstand that evil trend, and was a man who introduced the National Covenant, which, as you may know, the Scottish people were willing to sign with their own blood, that they would never become subject to prelacy, to Episcopalian terms, and they would endeavour to be free according to their own conscience to worship God. And Alexander Henderson is the man who wrote that very document, encouraged the covenanting principle in Scotland, and sent it to England, and it was ratified also in Westminster and became the uniting factor between England and the Scottish Presbyterians. Our notes give a whole series of various accomplishments of this man, and how he served the Lord in Edinburgh, St. Andrews, and was negotiating it with the King, and he served in the Assembly of the Scottish Church, and therefore he became the man to send to the Westminster Assembly to represent Scotland along with the other ministers. And he traveled to London by ship. He delivered the opening speech, or certainly one of the opening speeches, on behalf of the Presbyterian cause at the Westminster Assembly. And while there, he stood strong and firm, defending the principles of Reformed churches, and he withstood the Erastians. He sought to negotiate with Charles I, and he was a treacherous king, a king that nobody could trust, and he was the man that was sent to negotiate with the king, but he got nowhere. The king could not be trusted, his word meant nothing, and Henderson went back to Scotland, an ill man, and died in August 1646, when the large work of the Westminster Assembly was done, but not quite complete. And so he handed over the reins to others. And there his body lies in Greyfriars Kirkyard, Edinburgh. And it was a national event. He was such a large figure in Scottish history that his death and passing was a time of national mourning. So we need to understand that this document that we have, the Westminster Assembly, the Westminster Confession of Faith, that it has been produced by no mere small men, men with narrow minds or bigots, but men with great vision, men of caliber, of learning, and of genius, of powers of negotiation, and a willingness to serve church and state simultaneously. These were no sect hiving off into a corner to do their own thing. These were men who wanted to serve what was best for country and best for church, best for the people of God. And that is what we have in the Westminster Confession of Faith and catechisms, and in the form of worship and so on. Now, of course, this was an attempt to Presbyterianize the worship of England. What would have happened if this document had been accepted by the Parliament in 1647? If this had been accepted by the Parliament, you would have had Presbyterian government in Great Britain, in England, Scotland, Wales, and Ireland. Now, it was accepted in Scotland wholeheartedly. And the National Church, the Scottish Church, is Presbyterian, subscribing to the Westminster Confession of Faith and Catechisms, drawn up in London. This is the anomaly. The Scottish Church subscribed to the thing that was done in England. But unfortunately, due to turn of events in the Civil War, and the entrance of Cromwell and his Ironsides, the Parliament was disbanded, and this document, this advice that was given by the Westminster Assembly, was never fulfilled and passed and ratified. Therefore, the church in England did not become a church based upon the Westminster Confession of Faith, did not become Presbyterian. However, in the providence and the goodness of God, this Westminster Confession of Faith was completed and has served many denominations, many groups of God's people, both in England, Scotland, Wales, Ireland, and around the world, unto this very day. And so our appeal is that we must not abandon this document. We must not think little of this document, but rather we must hold on to it with all our heart and mind. And in our Book of Church Order in the Free Presbyterian Church of North America, our Book of Church Order, where we want to define what we understand as Free Presbyterians today, there has been inserted statements, what we call declarations, declaratory statements, which clarify what we mean and the liberties we give to membership within the Free Presbyterian Church under certain headings, such as baptism, eschatology, and the magistrate. And then there's another section on the Holy Spirit, which was not so relevant in the period of time in the 1640s. But in this century, With the rise of the charismatic movement, the Pentecostals, tongue-speaking, gifts, and so on, it is very important that a Reformed Church has a document that teaches what we understand by the person and work of the Spirit and the gifts of the Spirit. And we have an addendum to the Westminster Confession of Faith clarifying what we understand as the ministry of the Holy Spirit. The Book of Church Order in the Free Presbyterian Church of North America is available, and we trust that it will be a blessing to all of our churches, to all of our people, and that we will stand four square. Now, interestingly, this week I had a call from a Presbyterian here in Canada, and he was asking my opinion of the Presbyterian Church of Canada and where they stand. And I explained that they have abandoned the Westminster Confession of Faith. They have adopted now a little booklet called Living Faith, which is a small little booklet, and they've gotten away from the historical Reformation values. And that's the whole idea. They want to get rid of any references to Reformation history. The chapter 25 that deals with the Pope as the Antichrist, of course, modern contemporary churches don't want to touch that one. So they want to get rid of this. And that little document, Living Faith, is only a shadow. It's nothing close to the carefully, skillfully crafted wording of the Westminster Confession of Faith. I also said in class that the shorter catechism, those who learn the question and answers, you'll never get better tonnage of doctrine for the short few words in the question and answers than in the shorter catechism. For economy of words, you cannot beat the shorter catechism. The amount of truth and understanding that are in those answers is absolutely amazing. And we certainly have no intention of abandoning and surrendering those truths and moving on to an inferior document to try and appease some contemporary and perhaps even a carnal mind. So this is our look today at the men of the Westminster Assembly. And we've really just looked at two of the 151 that were called to meet there. Many other great men, godly men, who were willing to serve church and state through those years of hectic turmoil in England due to the Civil War between Charles I and Cromwell. Yet they gave themselves to this work, believing that this would be for the greater good of church and state. And so may the Lord be pleased to help us to use this for God's glory, and may it be for the good of His church today.